ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi. I know, weird. It's Tuesday. What am I doing here? Well, we've been doing this show weekly for the last few months, and we really hope you like the new format. But I know a lot of people miss our big, long, deep dives into a topic. Well, if you're one of those people, you're in luck. For the last year or so, my colleague Avani Dias has been working on a podcast series about the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi. If you're listening, supervising producer Yasmin Parry has been helping out, and the team has created a really amazing series that I'm sure you're going to like. So we're going to be putting episodes of Looking for Modi here on our podcast feed. That means that on top of the normal weekly If You're Listening episode on a Thursday, you'll also get a Modi episode every Tuesday starting today. So don't fret, I'll be back on Thursday. But for now, take it away, Avani.
I was at a cricket match in India last year when something strange happened. India and Australia were about to play a match in Gujarat at the largest cricket stadium in the world. Australia and India's Prime Ministers, Anthony Albanese and Narendra Modi, were both there. They even rode around together on a chariot, waving at the crowd. But just before they got on, a journalist asked Modi a question.
How important is cricket to our friendship, Prime Minister?
After my time following Modi around India, I knew this was a faux pas. Modi stumbled out an awkward answer.
Well, we'll see you something tomorrow. It is better.
It's a long way from backpacking, Mr. Albanese.
It sure is.
This was not supposed to happen. Afterwards, all of us in the pack of journalists following the leaders around were told off. The question itself wasn't shocking. It was the fact someone asked a question at all. There's an unspoken rule in India. Journalists do not ask Prime Minister Modi questions. Ever. India's the biggest democracy in the world. In a democracy, you're meant to be able to ask leaders anything and hold them to account. But Modi's become so powerful, his critics say he's not dictated by the rules anymore. He's constantly passing laws now without allowing any debate. He has a tight leash on his image, and a spontaneous question from a nosy journalist could derail every carefully crafted story he's ever told. I'm Avani Dias, and I'm the ABC's South Asia correspondent, and this is Looking for Modi. For the last few years, I've travelled all over India, and I'm only just peeling back the layers on who Narendra Modi is. There are so many myths and legends.
There's a story about how he swam across a river and subdued a crocodile.
This is a man about whom an awful lot has been written and said when he's been a subject of intense scrutiny, considerable speculation.
It's actually hard to work out what his true life was like because there seem to be several hundred biographies of him now.
Modi is one of the most powerful people in the world as the leader of 1.4 billion people and the most populous country. India is now the globe's fastest growing economy. He's put it on the map. Countries like Australia and the US are desperate to get close to India, and he's changed this place. He's up for another election this year, and most predictions say Modi will win. And by the end of that term, he'll have led India for 15 years. He's become so popular, some say he's untouchable. So in this series, I'm going around the country, trying to get to the bottom of who this man is. What is fact from fiction? What's true and what's just part of the myth? How is it possible we know so little about one of the world's most powerful leaders? It's been hard trying to get people to talk to me openly about him. They're worried there will be consequences. But by the end of this series, I'm going to get some answers. This is episode one, Humble Beginnings. There are a lot of rumours and stories about Modi's life.
There's this almost mystical aspect to Modi. The folklore can extend to his childhood. You know, he fought crocodiles in the river in his village, or he swam with them or something like that.
So I'm going to tackle them one by one. First, the story about his tough, poverty-stricken childhood in regional India, because he's banked on this idea that he's a normal guy, different to the elite who previously ruled India.
I think there was a sense that the people who rule you do not care for you, do not speak like you do not come from, do not know the kind of hardships that you go through. There was a lot of discontent around that, and I think Modi came and was able to capture people's imagination.
This is Manisha Pandey. She is the managing editor of News Laundry, an Indian independent media company. And she says the story Modi tells about his early life as a poor outsider has won him huge support from ordinary Indians.
I think all that kind of cultivated his image as someone who is the antithesis of this closed circle of elites that run India. I think Modi came and was able to capture people's imagination in that sense that here was someone who wasn't part of the Luttian's elite, as we say. He was not an English-speaking person. He really symbolized the possibilities in an India where, you know, someone from very humble origins or from nowhere can come and rise up to a position of power.
But is this story really true? I wanted to know, what was life in his hometown of Vadnagar really like? So I went there. Modi's hometown in the western state of Gujarat is lovely and quaint. There's a massive lake at the centre. It's made up of a few narrow streets with concrete homes built right next to each other, painted in these pastel colours.
There is a large cow walking towards me because it has...
There are cows hanging out on the streets. Around 80% of India is Hindu, who believe cows are sacred, so millions of them roam around freely. I went with my producer, Som.
PM has sent him later.
Oh, we should look at it later, yeah. Som, can you use this? It'll pick up my question.
It has gone to him, yes.
Som is also my translator, so you're going to hear a lot from him in this series. Som came with me to Vadnagar to talk to people who knew Modi as a kid. People like Sharmil Das.
English abra tamna?
No.
No English.
No English.
No Hindi. Yeah.
That's me awkwardly telling Sharmil Das I can't speak Hindi. Sharmil Das Modi took us to his home. It's a one-story concrete house with a small front yard where he still lives in Vadnagar. It's a couple of streets away from the house Modi grew up in. By the way, basically everyone in Vadnagar we met is a Modi, but they're not related. When Sharmil Das was a baby, his mum died, so he moved in with his neighbours, Narendra Modi, his parents, and five siblings. So, Som, what did Sharmil Das tell you about Modi when he was a kid?
Well, Sharmil Das refers to Modi as Narendra Bhai. And he said they used to fly kites together and Modi was smart.
What did he say about the house and the neighbourhood? What were they like?
He said there was no toilet inside. They used to go outside and they would wash themselves in a lake.
After chatting with Sharmil Das, we walked to the house Modi grew up in.
So this is his house? No.
Yeah.
This is Modi's house.
A woman's doing her laundry nearby the old way. She's slapping it against a rock to get out dirt.
So no one lives in this house anymore? And when did they move? How old was Modi when they moved?
He doesn't know.
He was born here, but
he was raised over.
Modi's house is not some grand mansion, but it's not like he was living on the streets or in a slum either. It's firmly average. It's down a small concrete alleyway. No one lives in this place anymore. It's really run down. It was painted white, but that's all faded. It's got a big wooden door, and it's pretty narrow but long.
I don't think there's any doubt that he did come from, you know, a relatively poorer background or humble background. I don't think there's any doubt on that.
Modi's mother was still living in a modest house, despite her son being the prime minister, right until she died at the end of 2022. Manisha Pandey says the rags-to-riches story that Modi tells to differentiate himself and connect to people works, but it's maybe not that big of a deal in a country like India.
We have had prime ministers who've come from humble origins. I mean, you have plenty of stories like that in Indian politics with regional leaders, people who've come from very marginalized background, very poor backgrounds. And I think that's the beauty of politics and, you know, Bollywood and sports in India, that you can really come from nowhere and rise and become, you know, whoever you want to for these three fields. So I don't think he's the only sort of guy who's risen from nowhere. You've had a lot of that.
So myth one, Modi grew up in modest circumstances. Looks like it's true, but he's definitely not the first prime minister to come from humble beginnings. Now, there's another important story that Modi talks about all the time.
You know, no one really knows much about his early life except for the fact that he came from a really humble background. He used to sell tea at a platform.
When Modi was a kid in the 50s and 60s, he says he helped his dad at his stall. They'd apparently jump on trains and walk through carriages selling tea or chai to passengers. The job hasn't changed much since then. They're called chaiwalas here, and you'll find them on every train on India's massive rail network. And they announce their presence on the trains.
Chai, chai, chai!
And as Modi was climbing up the political ranks, he loved to talk up this story about the chai stall and his humble roots.
The strength of our democracy is demonstrated by the fact that a little boy who at one time used to help his father at his tea stall at the railway station is today addressing the United Nations General Assembly for the fourth time as Prime Minister of India.
I went to the local train station in Vadnagar, just near where Modi grew up, to find out how much of this story is true. The station is painted this faded peachy colour with big pillars at the entrance. It's only two platforms and there are two trains which leave here each day. You can smell the cardamom chai wafting through the air as families get ready for big journeys from here. And this is where Modi's dad, Damodaras, had a chai stall selling tea. But over the years, some of Modi's neighbours in Vadnagar have said they can't actually remember Modi working at the chai stall with his dad. Many researchers dispute that story. And a video went viral from 2021 of Narendra Modi's brother, Prahlad, saying Modi didn't sell tea. He says, Narendra did not sell tea alone. We're five brothers and we all sold the tea. So Narendra should be called a son of a tea vendor, not a tea vendor. This is the mistake of journalists. So yes, he came from humble beginnings, but did he sell chai? That story might be overstated. There's some disagreement about the details of his backstory, but many who knew Modi when he was young agree that he was strong-willed, even stubborn or arrogant. This is his childhood friend, Shyamal Das Modi again, who I spoke to with my producer, Som. So, Som, what did Shyamal Das tell us about Modi at school and when he was a teenager?
He said he was very smart, you know, and knew about everything and good at his studies.
And he had quite a strong personality, right?
Yeah, Shyamal Das said Narendra Bhai had a very strong willpower from beginning. Sometimes he would stand up in front of teachers to respond and dominate over them. And if he wanted to do something, and he would definitely do it. Shyamal Das also said, once Modi made his mind, he couldn't be influenced by anyone to change it.
When Narendra Modi was just eight, he found his way out of Vadnagar. He joined his local branch of a group called the RSS, the Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh, which means National Volunteer Organisation. The RSS has millions of members around India, making it the largest far-right organisation in the world.
they do tend to sort of focus on younger recruits. The proportion of the Indian population that's under 25 is huge, probably one of the biggest in the world, if not the biggest in the world. So it's that classic thing of, you know, if you want to indoctrinate a population, you go after young people, you get them when they're being educated.
This is Vikram Vasana. He's from the University of Leicester and he researches Indian political ideologies. There's a lot of debate about what exactly the RSS does.
It's sort of modelled on partly on kind of a Boy Scouty sort of, you know, getting young men together to kind of teach them self-discipline, put them in uniforms, patriotism, all that kind of stuff.
Members range from children to grandfathers. They're all men. They sing, they play games, they exercise. On his website, Modi says it's working towards social and cultural regeneration of India. And if it's just focused on games and activities, it's kind of like Boy Scouts. And he devoted himself to the cause, eventually finding a career within the RSS ranks. But when you look beneath the surface, the RSS may be a lot more than Modi makes it out to be. The RSS made Modi into the man he is today. So why did he get involved? Who are they really? In Modi's hometown, we get to Chandubhai Rami's place. Chandubhai Rami and Modi joined the RSS as kids. It was the only extracurricular activity in town. Every morning, they went to something called shakas or branches. Chandubhai Rami told us they are hour-long meetings and exercise camps. So what's Mr. Rami talking about here?
Yes, Mr. Rami said RSS mainly involves about organizing Hindus and building good workers.
Yeah, and he said that that's kind of the motto of the organization, right?
Yeah, he said you go to the shakhas. Shakha is like their local branch. And you interact with the other workers, other members, and learn from them. And from there, your love for country originates.
And Mr. Rami also said that he liked it when he was young because he was into singing and he got a stage to do that at the RSS. I thought that was interesting. And he told us that story about how he and Modi would learn martial arts at the meeting as well. It's called Vetracham and the kids would fight with bamboo sticks and shields.
Yeah, he said he remembered about playing that Vetracham game with Modi. And playing it filled him with courage because it could rip your skin or even make your hands bleed.
In a small town where there wasn't much to do, the RSS volunteers would recruit kids like Modi and Rami and take them to shakas. It sounds pretty innocent, but many researchers argue the RSS is far more sinister than it would like you to believe, and indoctrinating people from when they're little kids like Modi was.
It tracks quite neatly the rise of fascist youth movements in the 20s and 30s in Europe at that time as well, and is borrowing quite consciously from Italian fascism, Nazism, and so on. And the idea is to give Hindu men a kind of sense, not only of discipline, but of almost violent courage, of valor, so that they can kind of oppose all other forms of external influence on the Hindus that they think have made them a weak, colonized race. So it's a deeply kind of hyper-masculine, in some ways quite European movement about race and nationalism and all this kind of stuff.
The RSS was created almost 100 years ago, and researchers like Vikram say the founders and their mentors were inspired by fascists.
And so they just quite openly, you know, say nice things about Hitler, that he's the prime example of race pride and nationalism, and same sort of stuff about Mussolini.
I do want to make it clear, though, later RSS leaders have distanced themselves from that. But researchers also say the RSS is a paramilitary group ready to defend India at a moment's notice. It's a major claim. Paramilitary groups are broadly defined as any defence forces that exist outside of a nation's official structure. While some paramilitary groups support police and military efforts, many others have extremist elements, like the Oath Keepers in America, Irish Republican Army, or Russia's Wagner Group. So what is the truth? Is the RSS pushing for an exclusively Hindu state? And if this organisation is so key to Narendra Modi's life, I want to know what happens at their 68,000 shakas every day. It took me months to get access, but finally I went to one of them. So this shakha is happening basically on a grass patch on the side of the road, and there's maybe like 15, 20 people here, all men. And they're playing a whole lot of physical games, and then they're chanting a lot of slogans about Hindu nationalism. Volunteers put up a saffron-coloured flag, which has become associated with the Hindu rite. They're doing exercises where they punch in the air over and over again. Then they play tug-of-war with a stick. This group is mostly in their 20s, but young kids and elderly people also do these shakas. There are two things I want to find out while I'm here. Is the RSS really a paramilitary organisation? And how much is it pushing for an exclusively Hindu state? Physical training and fighting exercises are a huge part of what the RSS does, and that's why researchers call the RSS a paramilitary force, something the organisation denies. When I was speaking to the volunteers, they downplayed the significance of the physical exercise, saying it's perfectly innocent. This is Rajneesh, an RSS volunteer.
Can you explain what happened at the Shaka? Why do they do the physical exercises?
If you have to work for society, you need to be physically fit and mentally fit.
Why do people need to be strong for the country? What's the purpose of that?
If you have to work for society, you have to be physically fit. If you are physically ill, how can you work for society?
But a couple of years ago, the RSS chief, Mohan Bhawat, said the organisation can prepare an army to fight for India in a couple of days.
I mean, it's perhaps an unusual paramilitary organisation compared to, say, the IRA in Northern Ireland or something like that, which is much more overtly armed to the teeth, has guns and bombs and that kind of thing. Insofar as violence goes at the very heart of what Hindu nationalist ideology is about, they think Hindus aren't violent enough to other people.
The other thing I'm trying to find out about is that the RSS is pushing for an exclusively Hindu state. Just so you're across it, while Hindus by far make up the majority of India, it's still got one of the largest Muslim populations in the world. More than 200 million people here follow Islam, and there are tens of millions of Christians, Sikhs, and several other religions too. And when India was founded after it got independence from the British, its constitution was written to say India is a secular country, which means it has to be neutral and open to all religions. This is journalist Manisha Pandey again.
They were all very clear that we wanted an India which would be a secular nation, which would be a nation for all religions. This seems to be the prime driver of RSS in the sense that they had a very clear vision for India being a nation for Hindus first.
And for many volunteers, the focus on Hinduism is a draw card, like for Ambika.
And I joined RSS because I have an interest in Hinduism ideology. So that keep me satisfied that I am doing something for my society and for the nation. Like if I'm able to help anyone with my knowledge, that is also a contribution to the nation.
The idea that India should have Hindu dominance over other religions is called Hindutva. It's backed by a few organisations here.
In past, our society is divided into different sections. We want to remove all these things. We want to make a good society where everyone is equal, everyone is happy, a strong society that will create a strong nation and that will create a strong world. It's for betterment of humanity, actually.
At the Shaka, the volunteers chant nationalist slogans while they do exercises.
Bharat Mata Ki Jai! Bharat Mata Ki
Jai! See, the one slogan was Bharat Mata Ki Jai. It means this is our mother India, this country is our mother. Mother India, long live. Vande Mataram was another slogan you heard today.
Vande
Mataram! Vande means worship, Mataram means mother. So worship your motherland. Another was Jai Shiva, Jai Bhavani. So Shivaji was a Hindu emperor, a great emperor. So we remember him.
Bharat Mata Ki
Jai!
Vande
Mataram!
Vande
Mataram! We are Hindu, we are part of this land. We are living here for thousands of years. So the knowledge tradition which our ancestors developed, it's all belong to us.
And what about the other religions that have come to India?
We welcome all religion that came to India.
Bharat Mata Ki
Jai!
At the RSS meeting, volunteers were careful about what they said to me. But the RSS founders were explicit about people of other religions in India. M.S. Golwalkar, who was one of the most influential people in the RSS, wrote, quote, "The non-Hindu people of Hindustan, which is another name for India, must adopt Hindu culture and languages and respect. They must entertain no idea but those of glorification of the Hindu race and culture." Some of the criticism of the RSS, that it's violent, that it will do anything to further the goal of Hindu nationalism, comes from its history. One of the most famous Indian people ever, Mahatma Gandhi, campaigned for India's independence from the British colonizers and led it through non-violent means.
Mahatma Gandhi, the great leader of modern India, assassinated in 1948, was born at Porbandar in West India.
Friends and comrades, the light has gone out of our lives and there is darkness everywhere.
At that time, the RSS thought Gandhi was too accepting of Muslims. This is Vikram Vasana again, who has researched the Hindu right.
One of the reasons they hate Mahatma Gandhi is because he's preaching non-violence.
In 1948, Gandhi was assassinated during a prayer meeting in Delhi by a man named Nathuram Godse. It turned out Godse had been a member of the RSS, and the organisation was banned for almost 18 months, even though it later denied any connection with him.
It's the reason he gets assassinated, that these guys believe he's taking India down the garden path by preaching non-violence, and through that, India will continue to be dominated by foreign powers and by Muslims and so on.
Gandhi's assassination is not the only time RSS members have resorted to violence. In 1979, a government commission found the organisation was responsible for creating a climate conducive to a riot in Jamshedpur in East India, which led to the deaths of 79 Muslims and 25 Hindus. In 2018, a Hindu procession by the RSS and Modi's political party turned into violent clashes between Hindus and Muslims.
So insofar as, you know, they need people to be violent, and the RSS is quite explicitly a kind of militarized organization in that sense. And the idea is that its violence is to be used, in their case, against the Muslim population when the Muslims step out of line. These groups routinely engage in vigilante violence against, you know, Muslims who are thought to be dealing in kind of cattle and cow meat and that kind of thing. Muslims who, you know, it just might be relatively successful small businessmen, and this offends the local Hindu population and so on, and their businesses are burnt down and so on. These are people who have gone through the RSS Shaka system often, and they're and kind of using that indoctrination of, look, violence is the way out of Hindu problems, as a way of kind of putting Muslims in their place. So for me, violence as a tactic has been not only there from the beginning, it as far as I'm concerned, the reason the RSS exists.
But the RSS consistently denies it sparks religious riots and reiterates how the organisation has helped out with relief after several natural disasters.
They may deny it, and they may deny it obviously for political reasons, but the evidence is fairly clear to me, both in terms of what their leaders wrote in the 20s, 30s, 40s and 50s. And then you just have to see what they do. And it seems pretty clear cut to me.
At the Shaka, the volunteers are adamant the RSS is making India a better place.
And what do you think of the influence of the RSS? Because it's become so big in over, what, nearly 100 years now. Where do you see it going in the future?
There will be no RSS in future. The purpose of RSS is to make a society where every individual is good, that follow moral values, that follow, that work for betterment of society. So when will we achieve this purpose? There will be no need of RSS. The whole society will be like RSS.
So going by what the RSS founders have said, that means the aim is for India to be a Hindu supreme society in just under 25 years, which is when India celebrates 100 years of independence. The RSS isn't just an extracurricular activity in Modi's youth. It's become a defining feature of who he is as a man and a politician. As Modi got older and became less interested in school, he devoted himself to the RSS. Eventually, he worked his way up through the ranks. It was instrumental in Modi's political rise. Indian politics researcher Vikram Vasana says he's careful not to make it too much a part of his story, a part of the mythology that surrounds him, but that his leadership and many of the policies his government and party have brought into India mirror the RSS ideology.
So in that sense, I think he actually is very much an RSS prime minister. It's just he's very clever about how he allows the ideology to kind of run its course. He doesn't stand in the way of it, but equally he doesn't stand up there like Adolf Hitler and make very, you know, anti-minority statements and that kind of thing. He's quite cagey about, you know, the extent to which he wants to hitch his wagon to the RSS, partly because, of course, the RSS has a history of saying things that are just so overtly Islamophobic that it might become a problem. Also because they're off, you know, that some of their cadres have actually been engaged in violence.
In 1951, RSS members created a political arm called the Bharatiya Jana Sangh. 26 years later, it merged with parties with different views and turned into the Bharatiya Janata Party, or the BJP, which means the Indian People's Party. But it still had links to the RSS. Modi joined the BJP, and the party now has a majority of seats in India's parliament and rules 12 states.
In my view, it's impossible for Modi and the BJP to have enjoyed the kind of political success they have had after the 2014 election without the groundwork laid by the RSS.
Since Narendra Modi became the leader of India 10 years ago, he's been pushing the idea that India, the secular country, is a Hindu-first state, enacting laws that critics say have marginalised and persecuted religious minorities. As Prime Minister, Modi's campaigned for Muslim religious sites to be replaced with Hindu temples, locked down India's largest Muslim region, Kashmir. The United Nations called a law his government passed in 2019 fundamentally discriminatory for leaving out Muslims. Modi's relationship to Hindu nationalism is central to his career. We're going to get into it a lot in this series.
I think we've got to the point now where it's starting to be questionable whether India is really a functioning democracy anymore. So in that sense, I think Modi's essentially destroyed Indian democracy. And if he gets another 5 years in power, even if he, you know, was booted out from power in 2029, India would take a very long time to recover, I think. And I think it's deeply, deeply concerning and quite tragic.
Journalist Manisha Pandey says the reason Modi's been able to sell his perfectly curated story about himself is because he controls how it gets disseminated.
You've had a prime minister who's refused to engage with the press. You have almost North Korean levels of obedience in major primetime anchors, major primetime news. I think what has significantly changed is how institutions work. You tend to think that democracy is alive in India because we hold free and fair elections, and we do that. We do that really well. But I don't think it's just about that. It's also about institutions and the independence the institutions have. And in that sense, I think media, journalism, which is supposed to be the fourth pillar, has completely diminished in the last 10 years in its role.
At the same time, India is now seen as a powerful political player in the world, and millions of Indians feel Narendra Modi has improved their day-to-day lives.
If you speak to an ordinary Indian, I do think that there's quite a lot of respect and awe for Modi because he rose from nowhere and he's come to become the prime minister. And not just that, I think people now look at him as a world leader. It's the stories around him now, it's not just about, you know, this person who, you know, this humble tea seller's son who became the Prime Minister of India, but who's really become the world leader. That is an inspiring story for a lot of people, that, you know, if he could do it, so can we. Namaste, Sada Vatsale Maa.
At the RSS meeting, members like Rajneesh insist their organisation doesn't have a political stance. But he says as an individual, he backs Modi.
As a citizen, it's a moment of pride that a common man who have no family background, no political family background, can become Prime Minister of India. It's a moment of pride for every citizen of India.
And what do you think will happen in the election? Will you support him, or will the RSS support him? What do you think?
See, RSS is not a political organization, you know that. We believe in man making only. But Narendra Modi is doing a good job. As a citizen, I think those who wish that India should lead, they should support Narendra Modi. So as a citizen, it's my right to vote, so I will vote for him.
Bharat Mata Ki Jai.
Bharat Mata Ki Jai.
We put in repeated requests for an interview with Narendra Modi. We didn't hear anything back. Eventually, the RSS wants you to give more. Once you get more senior, you become what's called a pracharak. You leave your family life, your job, and just give everything to the cause. It's like becoming a monk. And crucially, pracharaks promise to stay unmarried. Modi had big ambitions to get high up in the RSS, but an arranged marriage was holding him back. That's on the next episode of Looking for Modi. This podcast is by me, Avani Dias, and produced by Madeline Jenner. Additional production by Yasmin Parry, Som Patadar is our researcher, and audio production is by Anna John.